My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight with the St. Cloud 10th Annual Roundup. Glad to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Glad to see some old friends here and a lot of new friends. Glad to see the misspent youths from Moorhead.
What should we say now, Louie?
I'm sure Don Nichols, wherever he is saying, I knew that Igor brought me the wrong brains. Yeah. I'm glad to see people from a number of places here and see some of my old friends from Central Group, Central Pacific Group in Minneapolis who... Oh, don't clap for that dreary little group. I wouldn't even have mentioned them, but they bought my dinner. But it's a nice group. I'm glad to see some of you know Marv and Spooner and his wife Marge, and they're the only married couple I know that have 80 years of sobriety between them, and they just got married. I guess they must have had a wonderful honeymoon. One read chapter 5 and one read the traditions. Yeah. There's an old guy in our group named Ben, and he's 92 years old. He got sober when he was 75. He got 17 years, and one of his favorite lines is, you know, I'm so lucky. He said, I'm 92, but I still have a lot of fire. And physically, my age doesn't seem to bother me. I have this young girl waiting for me at my apartment, and I can't wait to get home after the meeting. And it's going to be wonderful. I said, gee, that's really great. He said, but there's only one problem. I said, what's that, Ben? He said, I can't remember where I live. And I got a very great treat today. As most of you know, I grew up in a little town called Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which is not far from here. And I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I'm glad to see you got a lot of Norwegian Lutheran churches in this town. Didn't see hardly any Catholic churches. But I was sitting at noon in my room, just kind of sad and forcing myself to watch a football game. And my friends Dave and Jan Isaacson from Eau Claire came to the door, much to my surprise, and brought me a Norwegian Lutheran emergency kit, which has butter and lefse and brown sugar. And I just sat, and like Papa eating spinach, you could just... So I'm just happy to be here tonight, happy to be safe and sane and sober. I'm traveling with some guys. I should really mention this because they're guys who came from Los Angeles with me. Your speaker last night, Johnny Harris, who certainly gave a fine talk and who was a pleasant traveling companion, is a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous in his home group. And Byron Wallin and John Stockdale, who are guys I've been fortunate enough to sponsor. And one of them's got 31 years now and one's got 26 years. And we travel at this time of year every someplace, and we always go someplace. We came here this year. There's supposed to be a guy with us from Australia, but he couldn't get on the plane. The plane was loaded, so he's meeting us later on. But it's great to be here. We were talking today as we walked outside to go out to dinner this evening that you forget how nice it is in this part of the country. That air is so clear and so sparkling, and the streets are clean, and there aren't riots and goofy people and craziness, and it really was nice to be here. We were talking that wouldn't it be nice to live here for maybe 2 days, you know. Just, you know, the third day you just have to have some action. But I mean, when I used to visit Eau Claire, visit my father when he's still alive, for the first night or two, I was there. For the third night, I'd wake up in the middle of the night and I'd hear a sudden silence. And I'd say, what was that? I need faraway sirens and car alarms going off and the sounds of breaking windows to make me feel secure. But we are not really here to discuss my personal reminiscences. I used to drink, and I drank, as most of you did, I'm sure, for some time. And like some of you, perhaps unlike some of you, alcohol really did not seem to be a very terribly important thing to me. I hear people sometimes when they talk in AA, they say, boy, all my life I had to move next door, I had to move to this house because it was near a liquor store, and on and on. And I never felt about alcohol that way. Alcohol was a dear friend of mine, and I loved it, but I never gave it a great deal of thought except when I was drunk or in trouble or something. But as a rule, alcohol was not my... I never construed alcohol to be not in the top 10 of my problems. My problems were much deeper things. My problems were feelings and the way people treated me and my own emotions and always feeling I wasn't being treated fairly by life and being screwed around a lot and people didn't like me well enough and on and on. Over the years, I've talked a lot about these emotions, but I suppose to make it a little succinct tonight, I could probably break it down into three general areas as I look over my life. I'll tell you, most of the feelings that I've had in my life, I never really identified going through them. I identify them later. Many times, listening to somebody else's fifth step and saying, oh yes, and getting an identification, seeing what it was like on the outside. And if you're new, I'm sure there are some new people here tonight. One of the disturbing things when you're new is that everybody else seems to have their life seems to be in such good packages. The speakers get up and say, and then in 1949, I realized things were taking a turn. So I moved on. And in retrospect, it's easy to put it all together. But when you're going through it, we were just as goofy as you are. I'll tell you. The analogy I sometimes use is a few years ago, I was kind of a Civil War buff. I took my son, who was at that time 11 years old, I took him to Gettysburg, and I showed him the Gettysburg battlefield. And I told, you know, we were out there, and I really gave him a story on the battle. I told him, here's Hood, was assigned to come up Emmitsburg Road and attack this ridge in enfilade, while on the other end, Ewell was supposed to attack. But at the same time, the Union Third Corps was moved out, and I really gave him a lot. And I really gave him a little bit more than he was prepared to listen to, actually. And I looked down, and the kid was going, And I just tried to explain to him. I said, I know a lot more about this battle than the people, anybody who fought in it, kid. Did you really? But I thought about that later. I know more about the Battle of Gettysburg than anybody who fought in it. Because I've read all about it. I knew what everybody was thinking. I knew what the Union generals were thinking. I knew what the Union regimental commanders were thinking. I know what the Confederate generals were thinking. I know what the strategy was that only Lee and Meade knew at the time. I know all about everything about it. The guys who fought in that battle, all they knew was, oh, Jesus, here they come again. And much of life is the same way. When we're going through it, it's, oh, here they come again. But when we talk later in AA, we say, yes, and then I had this plan. And then, but in looking back over my life, I look at it, and probably one of the major areas of my life that I really didn't identify, always had the feeling, but I couldn't really put my finger on it, was that for some reason that I couldn't make out, it seemed that again and again, people treated me as though I were not quite enough. They never said anything about it, and nobody ever said, you're not enough because of this. But it just seemed to me that people did not accept me as much as they accepted each other. It seemed to me always my life. Other people seem to like each other more than they like me, and I don't know why. There's something that's not quite enough about me, and I don't know what it is. I wish somebody would tell me. But you fall into a little trap of when you get feeling like that over a period of years, you develop certain defense mechanisms that you don't know they're defense mechanisms or that you're doing it, but where you put up a little dog and pony show or a little action or little tricks so that people will think will not see that you're inadequate. And I remember going to college and reading about defense mechanisms, but it never struck me once. That's what I've lived my whole life, with the defense mechanisms. And after I got sober, discovered what I was doing, I thought maybe I was the only one who had. Then as I learned more about life, I realized every human has defense mechanisms, because without that, we'd be living in caves, because you have to disguise basic self-centered feelings. But mine, in a way, because I was much of a reader and I spent much of my life as a writer, I always kind of hid behind imitation intellectuality. You know, things like, you know what we've been discussing? Do you have any idea at all what Nietzsche said about that? No, I really didn't think you had. That's one end of the spectrum. And there's all kinds of... The other end of the spectrum looks entirely different. If you didn't know it, you wouldn't think it was the same ballpark. But it's exactly the same thing. The guys who say things like, I got a new Harley, I'm going to drive it up your ass. And it's always the same thing. Stay at a distance and believe what I'm showing you. Don't look too closely, because I may not be enough. And I always had those feelings. And another thing that goes with that, that is really a drag. In retrospect, I know what I didn't know at the time. But you slide into a thing after a while, after a few years, of beginning to think without even being aware of it. They are all what they seem to be. I'm the only one who has to keep playing roles to get along. And I have to decide what role they want me to play and then play it. And they can just go through life being themselves. It's not fair. Another great area of problems in my life was, it seemed to me that I was consumed more than most people with fear. Not all the time. And some of it was just ordinary fear, but I sometimes had terror. And I didn't identify going through it, but I felt it. I know that everybody gets afraid, but my fear seemed to come not when I was down and out, but when I was becoming successful. And this happened several times. Work my butt off to get a good job and be trying to hold it together. And all it needs to make me terrified is to start getting some criticism about what I'm doing. Or someone in that company writing a memo saying he's not up to our... or something. And it's almost an instinctive reaction. I got to get him before he gets me. Not with guns or anything, but just with nastiness. And I get very afraid, and I suppose in retrospect, if I were some kind of a psychologist, I'd say I had my basic sense of inadequacy and I was afraid they'd found out that I was inadequate and I was trying to disguise it. But I screwed myself in a lot of areas that way. The main area of my life that I suppose I had a lot of problem with, and really is underlying of most feelings, is that I've always felt I was too sensitive to emotions. I felt things too intensely. It just seemed that when I went through life, more things made me feel bad than other people. Now, I know you can't do anything in the world about the bullet with your name on it or the emotional arrow with your name on it. But I'll tell you, folks, there's a lot of arrows out there that are addressed to whom they may concern. And most people like me have little thin suits of armor and they go through life and most of them goes ping, 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 ping. And I just seem to be stuck like this a lot, you know. Boom, boom. And I'll tell you what that brings about. That brings about an awful lot of having your feelings hurt. I've had my feelings hurt so much in my life. I just always... We were talking about it the other night at a meeting. When I was new, even in AA, I found myself several times walking vast distances back to where I was staying for meetings because someone had hurt my feelings and I wouldn't ride with them. Now, I really punished them. But I've done things like that all my life. I won't go and eat with you. You've hurt my feelings. I won't let you buy me dinner. To hell with you. I almost did it tonight, but my hunger overcame me. And I'll tell you something else that happens too. Then you become very easily rejected. Much of my life, I have been able to see rejection where no one else can see it. I can hear it in a tone of voice. I can see it in a memo. And people say, oh, no, you're putting too much importance on it. They're not rejecting you or anything. Oh, but I know they are. And it really is a drag to go around with hurt feelings and being rejected and being sensitive all the time. And I've had one countervailing, seemed to me, emotion that was positive in my life that I could identify, and that was, I have always had a great deal of ambition. I really want to be something. I really want to be something. And I thought that was a great ambition. And since I've been sober and working with other people, I've seen that emotion a few times. And when I see that emotion that I had in other people now, I know we're going to have a long, hard recovery from that. Because that is not a good emotion. That is not ambition. It is the sick reaction of an inadequate person saying, I want to be something so I can show them. Not so I can be something, but to show them. And there's never enough for that. There's never any end to it. You can show them for a while, but pretty soon you got to show them some more. And there's never any end to it. But I wanted to do something. I didn't identify these emotions, but I felt them and I tried to identify them and looked at them. So as a young man, I went into psychoanalysis. A lot of people, I was working down in for Fairbanks Morse in southern Wisconsin, and I went into psychoanalysis. Now, a lot of people say you shouldn't go into psychoanalysis, but I loved it. What are you laughing at? Another one of that bunch. Huh? Was that funny, Louie? But anyway, I loved psychoanalysis. I got to really love it. I discovered things that I don't know where the hell I'd learn them if I hadn't learned them there. I made breakthroughs that, for example, I discovered, I've talked about this many times, but you can never be talked about too much. I discovered, now I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, as I said, in Eau Claire. And in Eau Claire, the Norwegian Lutheran Church was the number one church. And my church was kind of a strict church, as all Norwegian Lutheran churches were. In that era, not Missouri Lutheran weren't, but Norwegian Evangelical Lutherans were. And I was raised in this church and went through catechism and all these things. And it was a strict church. As to me as a kid, it seemed to me they only really had two main rules. You don't sin, and you don't monkey with Catholics. That's about all. It really is true. And that seemed a reasonable enough rule, you know. As I got older, I seemed to have stirrings within me, and I seemed to be weak in my moral fiber, and pretty soon I got sinning, and then I got monkeying with Catholics. Then I wound up sinning with Catholics. So there isn't much hope for you then, but you know you're going to go to hell, but at least you might as well, you try not to think about it as much as you can. The doctor I was going to in Milwaukee, Dr. Hurley, as I recall, pointed out to me that it wasn't that way at all. That I had been repressed and psychologically scarred by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. Do you know what a heartache that is to find out that your own church has psychologically scarred you? Tears welled in my cheek. I always try to think highly of them and look what they did, you know. If I knew then what I know now, I would have formed adult children of Norwegian Lutherans. Could have hired a couple codependents and sat around and been pissed off every week. I discovered in psychoanalysis that I had been psychologically scarred by the Depression. Didn't even know there'd been a Depression. I discovered that my deep feelings of rejection, in many ways, were started by my parents. And I thought, what a sad thing. Because as he pointed out to me, you know, when I was a little boy in Eau Claire, my parents were both teachers. In the Depression, they had to go to other towns to teach. And I'd live with my grandma and grandpa down on 8th Avenue, Niagara Street. And stay with them, and I was their only grandson for hundreds of miles in any direction, so they just treated me like a little prince. They were from Norway. And the Depression, people were really poor. You know, they'd make homemade root beer, and they'd make homemade, everything was made. You'd buy things and make it. And I could go to my grandma almost any time and say, "Grandma, I want some root beer." And she'd say, "Oh, look at here, Tony. He wants some root beer." And my grandpa would come over and say, "Well, here's some cookies, too." When my parents came home, it just went to hell. "I want some root beer." "Not before dinner, sonny." "What do you mean, not before dinner? I want some root beer." "No. I want some root beer." "What?" "Why don't you go back where you were and leave Grandma and I alone?" And I discovered years later in psychoanalysis that when they left, it gave me a deep feeling of rejection. I discovered a lot of things. I used to think a few years ago, I was wondering, why did I love psychoanalysis? I always have a pleasant memory of it. And I don't know why, because all I ever got was bad news. You know, just... I spent money, and it took me a long time to discover why I like psychoanalysis. And I might never have really learned it, except the last 4 or 5 years, I've seen the phenomenon around Alcoholics Anonymous that has taught me why I loved psychoanalysis. There are now therapies that do the same thing for people that psychoanalysis did for me. Whether they intend to or not, or whether psychoanalysis should have done it for me, is extraneous. It happens. And that is this. There has been built up in the last few years something that was built up in me in the 1950s, a cult of victimization. I am a victim. Now, what is so wrong about being a victim? Let me tell you what's wrong for about people like you and I getting in the cult of victimization. It's just this. Let me put it this way. I've been around AA a lot of years, and I've been all over the world in AA, and I've known people all over the world, and I've known people very well, and I've sponsored a lot of people. And I would say the people I know in AA over the years have learned to know, there are at least two basic emotions that every alcoholic who comes to AA, in my experience, seems to have. They may not recognize them and they may not be obvious. But one is a deep lack of self-worth, and one is deep-seated guilt. Now, they may be masquerading in something else. Sometimes they have to be sober months before they can even identify what they are. But they're there. And these are the kind of emotions you don't get away by reading a book or by going to a few meetings or doing things. These are long-term, painful recovery things. They can be done. I know it's happened in my life. But the thing is this. There's no quick way that I've ever found, except by drinking, to rid myself of these feelings. One of the reasons I drink, because it rids me of those feelings temporarily. What would you say if I could tell you there are therapies that will rid you of guilt quickly? Will rid you of guilt quickly. And there's no way to get rid of guilt, but they can get rid of guilt quickly. I'll tell you what it is. It is to accept the role of victim. Because when I'm a victim, none of this was my fault. It was their fault, and the people who did this to me, and the people who have ruined my life, and the institutions, whatever it may be. But it is their fault. When it is their fault, it is no longer my fault. And there's a profound sense of relief in getting rid of guilt. Now, what would be wrong with this? What would be wrong with this being getting rid of guilt this way? It seems pretty ideal, I think. There's only one thing that's wrong with it for people like me, and I presume like you, if you feel the way I do about things. And that is this. In order to sustain the absence of guilt, and to sustain the role of victim, whether you intend to or not, you must sustain the resentment toward those who have done it to you. You may say you don't, but you do. If you ever go to these meetings where there are, and I'm not putting them down at all, I'm just talking about them honestly and straightforwardly, where people are gathered together to discuss what other people have done to them, you will never see anybody leave those meetings smiling, because they have been there to reinforce resentment and almost compete in who has been treated the worst. Not funny. Funny, but not funny at all. You sustain resentment. Secondly, the role of victim brings about another thing. It brings about, whether you intend to or not, it brings about profound feeling of being different. That I would have been like everybody else, except this was done to me. This scarred me. This hurt me. It is not my fault. I could have been a contender, but no, they had to screw up my life. And the third thing that comes with it is naturally a contiguous feeling with that is a deep self-pity. An ongoing self-pity. I really would have been something. I really could have been something. But no, they hurt. Now what's wrong with that? That might be a small price to pay to get rid of guilt. Not too much. Except if you ever read that blue book called Alcoholics Anonymous in its pages, it's a funny thing. It outlines our three most fatal emotions. Our resentment, feelings of difference, and self-pity. They're the three things that destroy people like you and me. You may even stay sober, but they erode you from the inside out. When I was in victimization, you never really feel good when you are a victim, and you will never feel really good as long as you live. You may have moments of elation when you found a new breakthrough proving why it still isn't your fault. But I'll guarantee you in the long run, you will never really feel good. It's kind of funny, except over the last few years, I've watched people who were doing well in AA, who get into some of these therapies that tell them you're not really feeling good at all. You're kidding yourself. And they get into those things, find psychological and intellectual breakthroughs, little by little get out of AA, because AA is kind of an amateur night compared to these things, and it cost them their life. It cost them their life. Maybe you'd like to go over their caskets and have a few laughs at that. A guy in our group about 4 years ago gave up AA, and he was doing well. 4 years sober, a guy named Chuck Barnes, gave up AA, got deep into the adult children of alcoholics, whether they intended to or not. Not the Al-Anon version, but the professional version where big bucks are to be made. And he got into that, and little by little, when I saw him about once a year after that, he just looked worse and worse. And he told me how much better he was feeling, and he learned so much about what had been done to him. And about 3 months ago, he never did drink. He just went home one night and hanged himself. He had learned enough to hang himself. Now, that's a hell of a way to live. But I was into that victimization, and I didn't really feel good all very much at the time, but I loved it, because nothing was my fault. I could always tell people how sad my life was and how I could have been something more. I got into metaphysics, and I read Nietzsche, and I read other books. I got into kind of little fringe imitation spiritual things where we sat around on back porches in the middle of the night and discussed the true meaning of the universe until the sun came up and we all had to hurry back to our caskets. Get our wives up to go to work. But I've done a lot of things like this over the years. But the one thing that helped me the most, more than any of these therapies, was something that I discovered when I was a boy, 15 years old. Ran away from Eau Claire early in the Second World War, got to San Francisco, lied my age, got in a merchant marine ship, and on that ship, some men intimidated me into having my first drink of whiskey. And to the best of my knowledge, I'd never been around a bottle of whiskey at the age of 15. That sounds ridiculous now, but the Norwegian Lutherans weren't. I mean, there are a lot of taverns, but grown-ups went to taverns, not kids. And so I had my first drink, and it made me sick, and I threw up, but I felt so bad then and thereafter that I wanted so much to impress them. I'd promised my mother and grandmother I would never drink, but I was more impressed with impressing them than my mother and grandmother. So I tried to drink and sneak in and nobody was around. And one day, the day before my 16th birthday, I held a drink down. And I hated it. It just made me so feel bitter. And all of a sudden, I got I didn't know it was an unnatural reaction. All I remember is that it made me feel significantly better all of a sudden. I suppose, in retrospect, if I were looking at it coldly, I would say that was the first day in my life that I ever felt the way men looked. But I didn't know that then. It just made me feel significantly better. But I didn't think a great deal about it, because I'll tell you, most life you learn about, you learn in your teens. You know, I know they got this book, All I Ever Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Christ, I couldn't even learn to sleep on my rug in kindergarten. I rebelled against that. I'm not going to sleep in any rug. I'm going to tell Grandma. She come down here and pour root beer on you. But in your teens is when you learn. You learn you might take a drink. You learn about smoking, at least to a degree. You learn about sex. You learn about working. You learn that your parents aren't going to support you for the long rest of your life. You learn about relationships. You learn how members of the opposite sex can make you feel wonderful and also make you feel like you wish you were dead. You learn all sorts of things. You learn, and the things you like, you try to stick with. The ones you don't like, you try to avoid. And drinking was something I liked because it made me feel good. It made me feel good. As I say now, I had no idea then. But then and thereafter, I'll tell you what alcohol did in my life, why I drank. And I never realized it. Alcohol, then and for the years after that, did something that nothing else that I ever know could ever do. It took a person who didn't feel like they were enough and made me temporarily feel more than enough. It took a person who lived with a lot of sensitivity and made me feel complete. It took a person who lived with fear and made me feel momentarily fearless. It took a person who was always being rejected and turned me at least temporarily into the rejecter. Now that doesn't sound much in a Rotary Club, I wouldn't imagine, or a church. But most people know here what I'm talking about. It is a great thing to go from rejectee to rejecter in just a few minutes. And I'll tell you, it's a great feeling. I'm sure some of you young guys have had the experience that I've had. Some of you old guys probably had it too, I suppose. But sitting late at night in a bar, having a few drinks, watching some old beast become beautiful by closing time. Maybe talk with your shoulders a little bit. I might sidle over to such an old queen at 1 o'clock and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension. Would you like to join me in the old Chevy? Now, if she would say, now, I don't know what I'd do if I were sober. Of course, I would never have the guts to ask the question if I were sober. But if I were sober, that happened to me, I guess I'd go to the washroom and hang myself. I don't know what I'd do. I'd just. But when I'm drinking, it looks different. When she says, now, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Hey, don't come begging tomorrow, bitch. I don't know anything else that does it like that, I'll tell you. And I love drinking. As I said, alcohol became the best friend I ever had. I guess that's kind of might sound bad to new guys to hear somebody say that in an AA meeting. But it still bothers me when I hear old timers get up and say things like, that damn alcohol. There's poison from the first drink. I just hate it. Ah, you know. You know, it's like hearing somebody badmouth an old girlfriend of mine or something. You know. Hey, wait a minute. She may be a pig now, but she didn't used to be. Yeah. Be loyal, I say. But I love drinking. Drinking got me through things, got me through a lot of things. I didn't become a terrible old drunk, but I tried to learn to drink. At the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital in Pleasant, California. I've just thought about this the last 2 or 3 years. What a miracle this was. I never thought about it. I've talked about this for 30 years. I never thought about it. I was in that hospital and the gray ladies came around and passed out some tests. And I took a test. Now, the miracle is this, because I've always been kind of an unfortunate, bizarre type.
if I were in a bad mood that day, I might have just said, I don't want to take any test. Or if I'm in one of my peculiar humor moods, I might have taken the test and made all the answers wrong just to show them I wasn't a sheep. But instead, for some reason I can't remember, I try to do the best I can for no apparent reason. Now, what is the big deal about that? I had no idea what the test was for. They just used up some forms as far as I knew. But they came back a couple weeks later and gave me my high school graduation equivalency. That's what that test was for. And so after the war, I was able to go to college. And just stop and think, if I hadn't taken that test, after the war, I'd had to go back to Eau Claire and try to be a junior in high school. I never would have been able to make it. My life would have been all different. But instead, I went to college after the war. And I was in the first class of veterans in the fall. And we, as has been said before, we all stood around the campus trying to look like steely-eyed, sex-crazed killers. Wondering if our unemployment check would come on time. I got married in college to a Catholic girl. My grandma was, God, she almost had a seizure. She said, oh, Sonny, she said, we all like her very much. She's a nice girl, but don't ever marry a Catholic, honey. You'd be very, it's not the same. I said, Grandma, we've been over the Pacific trying to fight the forces of bigotry and intolerance. There aren't any more Catholics in those things. We're all Americans. We're human beings. And I know you don't understand, Grandma, but we're going to get married. And I got married, and my grandma was right. Well, shit. It wasn't that she was a bad girl, just the opposite. She was a good girl. And there's one thing they never tell little Lutheran boys about little Lutheran girls. If you marry a good Lutheran girl, you are about to become the head of a rapidly growing family, whether you plan on one or not. And I couldn't believe it. You know, just pregnant right and left. And I used to plead to her and say, can't we use birth control?
No.
And I thought about that later. You know, if she had said yes, I didn't know what the hell I'd have done. Because in the 1940s, you'd take some guy with cojones bigger than mine to go into a drugstore publicly and order a birth control. God, you know. The toughest guys went in and said things like, hey, give me a pack of cigarettes.
And some condoms.
And I admired him for that much courage. And today things are a little different. If you're young, you know this. That, you know, at least in the drugstore by my house, the kids would say, hey, give me some condoms.
And some cigarettes.
You know, it's a, I guess that's progress, but I, she had Father Paul come by from the St. Patrick's Church to give me an hour lecture on the rhythm system, which is the Catholic version of birth control. And I listened intently. Just couldn't pick up that beat. So I started a career as a national distributor of small Catholics. Just. And I went out in the world. I became a sports writer, and I got into advertising. Then, as I had more kids, I had to get better jobs. I got into advertising and public relations. I had some success on the faculty of the university. Did quite well. And all these years, I drank. And drinking got me through and gave me the courage to do many, many things I never could have done, I don't think. Maybe the only problem I've ever had with alcohol is that sometimes, unfortunately, I drink too much. Or as I like to believe, many times I have been thoughtlessly overserved. And then I have a tendency sometimes to become semi-bizarre. And when I get semi-bizarre, then I get in trouble. And I was in trouble. So I was sent to my first AA meeting at the end of 1949. That's a long time ago, folks. Most of you, it's longer than most of you young pukes have been alive. We love you. Ha ha ha. But, you know, I was 22. Now, 22 doesn't sound terribly young in AA now. But then no one had heard of anybody within 15 years of it around Wisconsin. And they thought I was a young goof, and I thought they were all burned-out fools. And that's why today, I told Louie and some of his little friends about it earlier today, that I never want to go to meetings where there are a lot of young people and not pass along something to me that I wish those people would have passed along to me in 1949. You know, my home group, the Pacific Group, some of you have been there, in West Los Angeles, the biggest group in the world. It's like 1,100 people every Wednesday night, much bigger than this. Everyone, and exciting. And some of you have been there. It's very up, and a lot of young people in that group. And I want to tell you young people here, if you are like the young people in my group, I want you to know, and you should remember, you are the AA leaders of tomorrow. And if you are like the young people in our group, I want to tell you something else. I'm really glad I'm going to be dead. Jesus Christ, what a bunch of idiots. Dumbbells. I don't judge them, but... But I went to AA and went around, stayed around for a while, then I didn't go, and then I went again, and I didn't go, and I went to jail sometimes, and had some... But the next few years, I realized AA doesn't help people like me, because AA is designed to help people whose number one problem is alcohol. And when I get drunk, it looks like my number one problem is alcohol, but only I know it really isn't. It's considerably more complex than that. I drink to overcome my number one problem, which is myself. And so the next few years, I went to psychoanalysis, and I went to AA from time to time in different cities when the heat was on. I read books. I did a lot of things. And I became somewhat successful sometimes. But a pattern that I realized after I was sober for some time. I was successful several times, or beginning to be successful. Then a series of emotions and drinking would disintegrate it. Sometimes the emotions, sometimes the drinking that overcome the emotions. And I would wind up another series of bad breaks and misunderstandings and another thing to kind of slide over in my resume when I prepared it for another job somewhere else. And the day finally came in my life that I'll guarantee you cannot come to people of my background and intelligence and understanding. The day came in my life down the road that one day I found myself being physically thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And the guy says, "Don't come back, bum." And you laugh at that? Johnny Harris would have said that, you'd have cried. For Christ's sake. Well, but anyway, and I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I worked on, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. Some of you don't know what those are. They're a bunch of cows talking to each other about Borden products, which seems kind of funny, but they were so successful, Borden's going to bring them back next year in their advertising. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair, as you... And 3 weeks or 4 weeks before that, I had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail. So I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as cleanly as a... But I stood outside of the Midnight Mission in downtown Los Angeles, Skid Row. And I'll tell you, I felt I was dying. And I could not conceive what the hell had brought this about. If a guy had come up to me and said, "Your life depends on the answer, Slim. Are you an alcoholic?" To answer truthfully as I could, I'd have to say, "No, I'm not, but I wish I were. I wish my life were that uncomplicated. I wish my problem was alcohol, and I could go to AA and get sober and clean up my act, and things would work out. But again and again and again in my life, I know what happens. I get sober, and I clean up my act, and it works for a while. But one night, you're lying in bed at 2 in the morning, and here come your pals in to visit you again. Loneliness...
and resentment and feelings of difference and feeling that they're screwing you around and feelings of self-pity and feelings of discontent and feelings that you people aren't treating you right and this family is not right and the job is not right and the what in hell, why have they always been doing this to me? When those feelings start to come, you know it isn't going to be long then. Maybe a day or maybe a week, maybe a couple of weeks. But the day is going to come when you're going to have to say, what's the use? What's the use? I'm not like that. Go to AA and hear people say, if you're an alcoholic, alcohol is your number one problem. And say, I don't belong here, pal. And I, what do you do then? You just continue. You try to keep moving. And I stood outside of this mission. I didn't know what to do. But it started to rain. And so I walked 71 blocks out to the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax where there's a little AA club at that time that I'd been asked to leave a week before for getting in a beef. And I hung around that damn club. And I just felt terrible. And I suppose if we had a lot of time, I could give you an hour on what eventually changed my life in that area. But let me synthesize it by saying that in retrospect, I suppose what happened to me was this. Something happened to me there that I didn't know happened to me. Something that happened to Roland coming back on the ship. Something that happened to Bill Wilson but never really happened to Ebby. Something that happens to most of the people here sooner or later. And that is this. Without being aware of it, I surrendered to the fact that I was helpless. I didn't think they had anything to give me. I just felt I was helpless. And there's a one emotion. I've talked about it a lot over the last few years, off and on. But it's a strange emotion. It's one of the most deadly emotions you and I will ever have. It will almost always make you drink. And it's called extreme desperation. When extreme desperation comes, there's no argument, there's no logic, there's no thought can help you. And what happens is, if you surrender, I guess, without being aware of it, if you will allow someone else to guide that desperation, it is what saves your life. The same desperation that makes me drink, if I allow someone to guide it, makes me take actions that I would never take if I were feeling better. That I will take actions that intellectually offend me. I will take actions that seem square and stupid. I would never do it unless I were so desperate. That to me is one of the greatest arguments I know for sponsorship. That's to me what a sponsor does. A sponsor takes the same pressure that's making you go crazy and by steering it makes you take actions that help you get over being crazy. So same thing on those airplanes. We were landing the other day. Look out the window again. See that big jet. The same jet that makes us go 600 miles an hour this way, the same engine makes us stop because they change the thrust, but it's the same engine. And that's the way it is with my emotions. The thrust that makes me crazy, if I can surrender them, makes me get better. But surrendering them is the hard part, and it doesn't come easy. My Johnny was mentioned the other night, a guy named Chuck Chamberlain last night, and he was my second sponsor, was my sponsor for many years. And I used to take exception with him sometime. Because he'd get up and say, and he was a wonderful, the best man I ever knew. But he said, I never had a sponsor. And people say, see, that means we don't have to have a sponsor. That's what losers would say. And I used to have to reason with him and say, Chuck, you got to stop saying that. Because the reason you don't have a sponsor, because you and Bill Wilson, maybe there's somebody else, but I don't know who else it would be, are the only two men I know who came here totally surrendered. The rest of us have to surrender incrementally, little by little. It's a series of fights in your early sobriety. It's a series of actions you got to take, you fight against. And that's why we have sponsors. And that's what I think is most important to understand, that the purpose of it all is to enable people like me to surrender, to allow the pain to make me surrender enough to change the thrust of that desperation. And then as soon as you feel better, it goes away and pretty soon you feel bad again. You got to go through the whole action again because we don't seem to have much memory of what to do it until it gets to be a conditioned reflex. But eventually I stayed sober, is what I mean to say. And I had some little crappy jobs. And my first job was a furniture mover. I was living in the back seat of an abandoned car back at the AA club, and And I was feeling kind of moody that day, and I seemed to me the guys give me the heavy end of everything. And along about noon, he said, "Hey, you, without the teeth, you bumped my lamp." I said, "No, you're mistaken, sir. I broke your lamp." You just can't push creative people. I got a job as a busboy. I got a job as a dishwasher. I lost that in a couple of days because I would hate to defend it tonight, but it seemed to me that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waiters were taking out. Which led me to deduce they were getting dishes in other restaurants to humiliate me because I was an Anglo. I had a lot of crappy things. But what happened during those times, I mean, I was terrible. You know, a guy named Jim McCoy took me off, put me on the sofa for 2 weeks. Now, before Jim McCoy, another guy put me on the sofa for 2 weeks, a guy named Bob. And his wife made me, her husband made me get rid of me because she said I'd been putting out cigarettes under the sofa on the rug. And not very many, just when I was tired, you know. Then I was back in my car for a while. Then Jim McCoy put me in his house. And he was a healthy young man. And he was really sacrificing. He had a big kind of one room with a little bachelorette with a little kitchen. And I was sleeping on the sofa. And he slept in the bed. And he had a Murphy bed that pulled down. And middle of the night, one night, knock on the door. And he went to the door and came back. He said, "Clancy, my girlfriend is here. You understand, we haven't seen each other for a long time. And would you mind, I'd hate to ask you this, would you mind just taking a walk for a little while just so we can talk?" And I was tired and cross. I don't like, you know, I said, "Jesus, Jim, why don't you have her hit the street? She's more used to it than I am." Well, I wound up that night back in my little abandoned car. And it's just this dreadful thing. But little by little, over a period of time, something changed, and my life began to change without being aware of it. I never intended to stay sober because everybody is an alcoholic. And eventually, I stayed sober. And eventually, I never drank or took a pill again. And now, next Saturday, it'll be 34 years since the day I walked off that skid row. In fact, I'm glad I... Oh, don't! You misunderstand. I don't want your stinking applause. I want a love offering. I want to see hats moving through that crowd.
It's so goddamn wonderful here.
I'll send it to my mortgage company in your name. I want to, but I stayed sober. By desperately taking steps. And I've often thought, what was it that made me stay sober? I used to think, well, it was taking my inventory. That's what made me take. That was the change. Because I swore it. I told my sponsor several times, you know, why should I take my inventory with an out-of-work actor when I've taken it with a psychiatrist? You know, why take it with you? And he got testy, or he's always testy about something anyway. But I think a guy reminded me 2 or 3 years ago of something that had happened, and I had forgotten about it. And I look at it now, and I have come to believe that is the turning spot in my life. And I never would have guessed it in 1,000 years. Because I was about 5 months sober, and I was restless and discontent, and people were treating me bad again, and everything was going to hell. And I was going to meetings every night, and I had little part-time jobs, and people would buy me a hamburger in that damn club once in a while, and I was skulking a few pennies here and there, and it was just... But I was at the Tuesday night Central Hollywood meeting. The Central Hollywood meeting, in retrospect, probably was the weirdest single AA meeting in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, young guys all had, many of them had streaked hair with colors and so on, which doesn't sound so weird now, but in 1959 was really a little exotic. And many people wore costumes of the other sex. You know, women dressed like men, the men dressed like women, and some just dressed like elves, and it's the goddamnest thing. One guy had little boots with little curly toes. And the funny thing about it is that, in retrospect, that was my favorite meeting. I just loved to go to that meeting. I suppose it might be the only place in town I could find any lower companions. But I'd go there. And it really was a participation meeting, too, and that's what I loved. I'd never wanted to go to speaker meetings if I could help it. In fact, when I was new, Chuck Chamberlain came to speak to the 60th Year Club. I remember he started to talk, and I got up and left. I thought, Jesus, another champion. Screw this. You know, when you're really feeling bad, if you're new tonight, around A, you go to speaker meetings, you'll soon learn that it really gets tedious because they're talking about, you know, they said,
I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door and the desire to drink left me instantly. I now have $3 million with me tonight. Several different families have returned to me. I owe it all to one thing. I put the plug in the jug.
And if you're sitting there just thinking, which hurts least, cutting your wrists or hanging yourself? It really is a drag. In fact, when you're new, I've been able to turn off entire speakers because no matter how sad their story is, you know that sooner or later, before the Lord's Prayer, they're going to have to say, but then, one day, it all turned wonderful. And just waiting for that moment. Oh, Christ, there's another. I liked him when they were failing, but when they. I think AA would be. AA talks would be listened to a lot more, it seems to me, if every so often we threw in a speaker and say, and then it turned out, goddamn it, I just couldn't make it. That's really the way it is when you're living out there. You don't know you're going to make it. You don't have your sobriety. Only 5 days till my sobriety date. Wow, you know. But I was at this participation meeting, and I couldn't get called on. I got called on to these participation meetings just once or twice, and then I couldn't get called on again. I just thought they were jealous of me because I'd had been educated and was well-spoken. I discovered later the reason they didn't call on me because I'd get up there and I'd tell them what a bunch of crap AA was and didn't really work for intelligent people. I don't know why they didn't call on me again. But I was coffee break, and I was standing around the podium waiting for the secretary so I could suggest my name to him as the leader, I mean as a speaker. And I stand there, and I saw a woman in about the second row, like where she's sitting. And her name was like Mary Lisa or something, if I recall. And there's one like her in every group, you know. She was bright, vivacious, intelligent. Everyone loved her. Her sponsor adored her. She sponsored people who adored her. She was secretary of a group. They always called on her at all the meetings. The kind of person you just want to go over to and go, boom, 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 boom. Just smash. And I was just thinking, I wasn't going to do it. I knew better than that, but I was just thinking, be kind of fun to go over and give her one in the gut and just say, hey, Mary Lisa, take a bow. And I was thinking of that and kind of smiling. And all of a sudden, here comes my sponsor through the crowd. Not Chuck, a guy named Bob Bailey, was my first sponsor. He was tough. He says, classy! That's what I hated about him. I always thought someday he's going to say, classy! And I'm going to say, what? And I'd be thinking about that, and you'd say, Patsy! I can't stand being intimidated. Because then they know what a weakling I am. Is it classy? Yeah. He says, I want you to apologize to Mary Lisa. I thought, for Christ's sake. He can read my mind. I said, why, Bob? He says, well, last night. I thought, oh, that's a break. It was last night. He said, someone told me that at the Frank Randall group, you called her a bitch. I said, Bob, don't misunderstand me. I'm not trying to argue with you or make any trouble. But she is a bitch. Well, why do you think she's a bitch? She told her new girl not to go to bed with me. Well, she's absolutely right. You apologize. Then I looked at her, and she could hear all this. And she was going... And now, it just struck me. I would rather be dead than live like this. I would rather be laying drunk in the rain in an alley in Skid Row and have trucks run over me than to live like this. I've had enough! And I thought to myself, I'm leaving this. You know, this AA is great for these idiot simpletons, but it's no place for a brilliant man who's being screwed. And I used to be a good writer, and I was working out my resignation in my head. You know, I was going to say, Bob, why don't you take these 12 golden steps of recovery, season them with the 12 traditions, which are the group as the steps out of the individual, garnish them with the 12 concepts of world service, wrap them all in the 12 promises that never come true to anybody with brains, and stick them up your nose. Because I'd rather be dead than be like this! I was just about to lay this on him. I knew it probably would have destroyed him, but what do I care? When suddenly, a ray of light came out of heaven and illuminated me. Actually, it was just a passing thought, but it's more dramatic this way. Would you rather be Saul of Tarsus or Clancy of Venice, I say. But I suddenly had this thought. I thought, my God, I've been doing this wrong. Ooh, I've been doing this. You'll notice if you're new, most old timers have very little hair in front. They go through. I've been doing this wrong. I've been letting this guy get to me. I've been acting as though when he tells me to do something, I've got to want to do it or I've got to mean it. I don't have to want to do it. I don't have to mean it. I can pretend to do it like I mean it and fool him, and I'll be superior to him and these other prissy blue-lipped pukes. You know, I can play their sick little game. I mean, I'd had a lot of problems with Bob. He'd tell me things like, pick up the cups. I'd say, sure, Bob, not go out that door like a rocket. I'm not going to pick up cups. Say, help set up the meeting. Yeah, you bet, Bob. I'll be there early every night. You bet. And I wouldn't do these things if I had some integrity left. And suddenly realized, I don't have to lose my integrity to do these things. I just have to ridicule them in my mind while I do. And I become superior. Okay, Bob.
Sorry, Mary Lisa.
You bitch. I became something of an activist after that. Pick up the cups, Clancy. Sure, Bob. But I could think, you know why you don't get many parts in movies anymore? Because you're crazy. Help set up the meeting, Clancy. Sure, Bob. I bet you'd do it too if you could figure out how to open the goddamn chairs. Don't forget to thank the speaker. Sure, Bob. You've made me learn to love hypocrites. I never said that, but I felt it. And I became something of an activist, and it got me through a month. Till one day I lost my job as a dishwasher and decided to kill myself. It wasn't enough to keep me going. And that day I called my sponsor, something I had never done in agony, because that's something you never want to do. And he cursed me into writing an inventory. He took the pain that's going to make me go walk into the ocean that day, I guarantee you, and steered it into writing an inventory. And I wrote an inventory. Stuff I put stuff in there that I'd never told a soul. And somebody asked me later, you know, you said you wrote stuff in there you never told your psychiatrist. What would you not tell your psychiatrist? I said, well, when you're paying that kind of dough, you can't risk rejection. You'd hate to look up and see some guy saying, get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. You know. And later on, I took a fifth step. And pretty soon, he made me write the most difficult letter of my life. Write a letter of amends to my father, who was the most hated man in my life. Because he seemed to me that he had let me down when I needed it. And over a period of time, He is the source of my victimization, in a sense. Through the actions of AA over a long period of time, my father and I incidentally became rather close. In fact, we became closer than most fathers and sons that I ever knew. And he spent nearly his declining years in our home in Los Angeles. And we died up here. It was a real blessing. I remember sitting in the Norwegian Lutheran Church at his funeral and seeing all the old Norwegians, room almost not quite this big. And thinking to myself, I am so glad my dad was dead, and I'm glad he's dead. He's out of his pain. And sit there and think, just think, I spent much of my life in absolute fear of this room and what it represents. A Norwegian Lutheran God that I thought was trying to destroy me. And thank God I've been driven by pain to take actions that enable me to understand the same God is in this room as is in my meeting in West Los Angeles. A God who loves me and who wants me to do well if I can get myself out of the way. And I love the memory of my father. And the point I want to make in this, in a sense, is this, about victimization. If I had not taken those actions, if I had maintained my feeling of victimization of my father, to this day, if one of you come up and said, tell me about your father, I said, I don't want to talk about that dirty bastard. I hate him. He ruined my life. But instead, people say, tell me about your father. I say, nicest man I knew. Loved him, and he loved me. So the reason I say, be careful of that elusive victimization thing. It sounds so good going in. But usually has continued to help someone else live more comfortably. I stayed sober. By the time I was a year sober, I got a little job wrapping packages I was able to keep. And when I was 2 years sober, I got a little job as a medical corporation. I went to work every day. And I was 5 years sober as director of advertising for that big medical corporation. When I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought to Hollywood. We created the number one hard rock station in America, something called Boss Radio. You know, we all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? And 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director for Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of greed in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas, to a post office box, fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Thank God I was able to locate a metronome in the nick of time. And they're all grown up. Some of you know this. A couple of years ago, my year and a half ago, my oldest daughter was made an assistant attorney general in the state of New Mexico. Then she didn't like the inactivity. She went back to being in charge of DA's office. And she was home. When she came home at Christmas, she said, you know, Dad, we were little girls and we reunited and I know you loved us, and we loved you, and we were getting together for the first time. And remember when you got angry with us, or disappointed in us, you'd make us go to our little room, and I'd say, sure, honey, that I didn't want to slap you or anything. I did that because I love you. She said, I believe that's true, Dad, but when you come to New Mexico, I'm going to send you to a little room, see how you like it. Well, I know she was kidding, but I'm not going to New Mexico and find out. I'll tell you that. Yo soy el maestro. And so today I live in the West LA. Been sober a lot of years. Almost 34. And AA has been my only therapy. And everything is fine in my life. I really feel wonderful. There's only one thing I want to talk about for about 5 minutes. I'd want to keep us from our ice cream. I've got my ticket. No, I haven't got my ticket. Some newcomer got it. Well, I just say a newcomer got it, so you'll think I'm a giver. Keep coming back, newcomer. I got mine. Probably the most important thing I've ever learned in my life, and I'm the one I carry with me as long as I live. I finally found out what was wrong with me, and that changed my life. The most important thing I've said tonight, I said, my name is Clancy Imeslin, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, how could I be an alcoholic? Alcohol was never my number one problem compared to my emotions. And thank God I got enough activists and people who steered my desperation, and I surrendered little by little, painfully and with pain. And don't get the wrong impression. You think that, well, sure, a skid where you're going to surrender. But I don't. I've only worked in the last few years with maybe three or four people off skid row. I've worked with people who One guy's been on the moon. One guy's had a, still making $500,000 a year at his bottom. Psychiatrists, clergymen, doctors, lawyers, successful people. It isn't a matter of how much you've lost. It's when you've lost the feeling of yourself and you into that desperation. That's when it comes. Don't wait till you're on schedule, because most people die long before they get there or live in such agony they wish they were dead. But I'll tell you, I finally came to understand in Alcoholics Anonymous the most important thing I know, and it's just this. If I'm an alcoholic, my problem is not alcohol. Or conversely, if my problem is alcohol, I cannot be an alcoholic. Now, doesn't that sound upside down and crazy and goofy if you're kind of new? But I'm convinced that's the message of AA. That's what we're here about. That's the message of this book. I'm sure that I'm one of the few people in this room ever sat and talked to Bill Wilson at length, and that's what he told me, in effect, at least in his office in 1963. I don't think he changed his mind after that. But you say, of course the problem is alcohol. It's got to be. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem... running just a tad late, are we? Now I've lost my place and have to start over. My name is Clancy Imbleslund, and I'm an alcoholic. But if alcohol is the problem, then detoxes turn out recovered people, and they do not. If alcohol is the problem, treatment centers turn out recovered people, and they do not. Unfortunately, some people think they do, and they die as a result. If alcohol is the problem, hospitals turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. They turn out people who are physically sober with varying amounts of information on what may be wrong with them. But if they be an alcoholic of my type, and I presume your type if you're here, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later, they will always eventually have to drink or sedate. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. One other thing must be present, and that is that nobody knows why or the reason for it. But as far back as there's recorded history of alcohol use, in every generation there's a small percentage, 5, 6, 7% maybe, of people who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And so the question is, what is this unnatural reaction to alcohol? Because that will help you identify what it is. That's a very difficult thing to find. It isn't that you act crazy. Some people do, but some people don't. Today in my work, I see alcoholics die on a continuing basis. Some of them never acted bizarrely once. They get more and more catatonic. Is it that you stay drunk all the time? No human body can stay drunk 2 weeks, night and day, in a laboratory. Seems like you do, but it's in and out, in and out. Is it that you can't handle it? No. Alcoholics handle alcohol better than non-alcoholics in any kind of a test. Then what the hell is it? It turns out that it's something so simple that I never would have guessed it in 10,000 years. Alcohol must have the unnatural effect of almost instantly making everything all right. The strange thing is, it doesn't do that for other people. You can put it more clinically, say, alcohol has the power to almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly alter my relationship to my known environment. It must almost instantly change my psychological profile, if you will. But as far as I'm concerned, it must make me feel almost instantly all right. And it turns out it doesn't do that for over 90% of people. And that's why they don't drink. Alcohol must have the power to do this. And I know there's some people still today in AA, and there always will be people who come to AA, and their preconception of AA is, well, my problem really isn't alcohol, I can't be an alcoholic. You want to know if you're an alcoholic? The best test I know, quickly. Now, there are all kinds of tests. I mean, they have the 20 questions, they have the 40 questions. Hazelden has an 8,000-page book. There's all sorts of things. If you're not an alcoholic when you start, you are when you're done. I'm not putting it down at all. I'm just saying those are tests. But the best test I know I could give you if you're new tonight is this test, and you can take it before you leave the room. It's just this. Imagine yourself on one of the days that come in your life, and they come a lot, when your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate are ripping at your throat and everybody is screwing you around and you can't stand it. And somebody says, here, have a drink. If you take a drink, would you really be satisfied to have it go? No more for me. I'm starting to feel it. If that's what alcohol does in your body, you're wasting your time in AA. You could be over to world's biggest mall tonight looking at people. Boy, I wish I had money like they did. You know. But if it turns out you are like me, and I want you to think about it honestly, when your back's to the wall and the hounds of fate ripping at your throat, somebody says, here, have a drink. You discover it doesn't go. Blah, blah, blah. It goes. You want to try me, copper? Hey, Mr. Carlson, you know that job I worked 6 months to get? Shove it. You with anyone, Granny? It changes my perception of reality. There's nothing wrong with it. It's great. It works better than any narcotic I know. It's funny that AA people want to come here and say, I'm an alcoholic and a narcotic addict, as though there were something big. Narcotic addicts are people who try to induce with narcotics what I get on the natch from alcohol. That's as far as I know. Not putting down addicts. I've been working with addicts for over 25 years, and I know a little bit about addiction. Heroin, great, gets you great euphoria. But what kills heroin addicts, you can't get back to pretty soon. And you start overdosing. Heroin addicts always overdose because they're trying to get back to a euphoria they can't get back to. Cocaine, this romantic thing that gets you way up to omnipotence. It doesn't take long before the side effects of all speed attack you, the restlessness, the paranoia, the persecution complex, the terrible addiction. You got to keep getting it no matter what. But alcohol just puts you right where you are, and the world is technicolor. Boom. And it's great, except for one thing. If it does that for you, it little by little erodes your ability to cope with problems anyway. And one day, anything you become dependent on becomes a problem. And one day, drinking becomes a problem. So you decide to stay sober. Then you realize being sober is really painful, so you decide to drink. Then you decide you can't drink, you got to get sober. And that phenomenon is called alcoholism. Not alcohol. It is called alcoholism. And it manifests itself not by the drinking is bad, but you are in a combination of situations. Drinking has now become untenable, and sobriety has now become untenable. And there's no way out. Today there's AA all over the world. Today there are treatment facilities, hospitals, all sorts of things. In America today, where there are more sober alcoholics than anywhere in the world, it is estimated that maybe as many as 95% of alcoholics still die drunk or as a direct result of drinking. And based on my experience of watching people die, I'm sure they all die saying the same thing. But you don't understand. I am not really an alcoholic. My problems came when I was sober. I just drank to get some relief, then got a little out of hand. And they've just described the disease of alcoholism. I'll tell you how. Just a funny little thing in passing. I think about this now today. Recently I had somebody I sponsored had cancer. Now over the years I've had two or three people I sponsored have cancer and relatives. But where I've sat in UCLA in that cancer ward and watched them gradually die and watch the people around them die, it's like a hospice almost. And I sometimes think, what would they say if I walked in there and said, hey, I just learned about something. Would you go to an hour and a half meeting or an hour meeting with me every night for the next 5 years, if I could cure your cancer? They would sign over their house to you, they'd give you your car, anything you want, please take me to your meeting. You go to that county hospital in L.A., to the AIDS ward, which is as bad a place as you'll ever want to see. Skinny, open sores, dying, no way out. What do you think they'd say? Hey, got an idea for you. Would you take 12 steps, some of which don't seem very smart. Would you take those, and on a continuing basis, if I could cure your AIDS, they would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. Yes, take me, take me, take me. But you go to the alcoholic ward, where guys are lying, dying of alcoholism, with their liver out to here, their eyes are yellow, their skin is yellow, and you say, hey, we're going to have an AA meeting tonight. They say, not around here, take it down the ward, I'm not a goddamn alcoholic. And it's kind of funny, except you come back next month, and he's dead, and there's a new guy in that bed saying he's not an alcoholic. Now, if a guy hours from death can prove he's not an alcoholic, you and I can prove we're not alcoholics if we work at it. That's why you can't afford to work at it, because your brain can wind you out of here. That's why it's important to remember, getting sober and cleaning up your act will not make you better. It'll make it better for a while. But the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, it turns out, it's involvement, it's sponsorship, which is frightening. I know the guy thinks he can help me, but he can't possibly know as much about my problems as I do. How can I trust his judgment? But I have to trust him anyway. Take steps that don't even seem to have any application to anything I've got wrong with me, and do it anyway. Try to take actions and be involved where I want to just cut my wrists and keep doing it. Stay sober days. I cannot stay sober. And little by little, the purpose of AA keeps you sober. Is not to make you sober. The purpose of AA is to, after you are sober, perform a long-term, absolutely indescribable thing. And you hear sometimes people talk about how wonderful they become or how holy they become in AA. You don't become that way. You can become better. But no matter how hard you work the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings have ups and downs. What Alcoholics Anonymous has done in my life in the last 33 years and 51 weeks is not so much make me wonderful, because I'm not at all, but has done this. It has done, the purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol does fast. That's as far as I can tell you. Alcoholics Anonymous today, it has taken a person who has lived with not feeling good enough their whole life, and most of the time today, I feel good enough. Not all the time, because no human being feels good enough all the time. It takes a person like me who lives with fear all my life, and most of the time today, I am without fear. Not all the time, because I'm a human being, and human beings have fear. It takes a person like me who has lived with extreme sensitivity all my life, and most of my life today, I feel not too sensitive at all. Not all the time, because I'm a human being. But it's a continuing thing. Some of the young people here were asking me this afternoon, we were having a little talk in the lobby, they said, why would you still stay active in AA after all these years? And I'm sure that's a question coming up. Families ask that. Let me give you an analogy. I told them, it came to me this afternoon, maybe it'll help you. I don't know. But if people would never come up to me and say, how come you are still active in your church after being a member for 34 years? They would think that was wonderful. You are still active in your church while you're a veritable saint. Well, this, in a sense, is my church. I don't mean that you can't have other churches, but this is where I'm centered. This is where I've learned to worship God as I understand Him. This is where I've learned to live with some degree of dignity. And I keep active, not because I'm a good man, but just the opposite. When I don't, I lose what I'm finding here, little by little. I stay okay, but the world gets rotten around me. So I keep going to AA just to keep you all shaped up. That is why I'm glad to be here tonight, safe and sane and sober. Glad to be with good friends, old friends, new friends, active friends. Glad to be part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not because I'm wonderful, but just the opposite. Of myself, I cannot live with comfort in this world. But with the aid of a loving God, the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people such as you, I walk with some degree of dignity that I never thought possible. And I hope my steps never stray from that path. Thank you.